Trendstorm.
Welcome to Radio Sputnik and Trendstorm. My name is Andrew Kripko, and I'm going to give you a forward focus analysis of things to come and the general trends behind them. Here's what we have for you today. SPIEF, expanding the Russian Davos. The upcoming St. Petersburg International Economic Forum will see the participation of Indian Prime Minister Modi and the Saudi Energy Minister, among many other dignified guests. Manchester, we all stand united. The late-night suicide bombing inside of a packed music concert in Manchester shocked the entire world, but also brought the divided British people together in presenting a unified front against terror. And also, Trump-Salman alliance, all eyes on Yemen. The recently rejuvenated military alliance between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia could have enormous and immediate implications for the war on Yemen. Opening up this edition of Trendstorm is next week's economic forum in St. Petersburg. The upcoming St. Petersburg International Economic Forum will see the participation of Indian Prime Minister Modi and the Saudi Energy Minister, among many other dignified guests. Regularly referred to by pundits as the Russian Davos, SPIEF, as it's colloquially called, brings together some of the most important movers and shakers in the global economy. This year's event will see a robust agenda of panels, roundtables, and conferences, where participants will discuss a wide range of topics, including technology, tourism, industry, energy, and even international relations. SPIEF was originally unveiled in 1997, though this gathering has taken on a renewed significance in the past couple of years, ever since the West's anti-Russian sanctions and Moscow's consequent quest to diversify its economic relations. Russia has since used the platform to reinforce existing and pragmatic Western partnerships, while also spearheading breakthroughs and forging new, non-Western ones. The second category of engagement includes the Eurasian Economic Union's rapidly developing relations with East and Southeast Asian states, attracting investment deals from the Mideast, and strengthening the decades-long friendship with India. While Russia's high-level and comprehensive strategic partnership with China is a well-known fact in today's world, as is its ambition to build ties with ASEAN, comparatively less has been said about Moscow's economic engagement with the Mideast and its future vision for South Asia, both of which will figure prominently in this year's SPIEF gathering due to the participation of the Saudi Energy Minister and Indian Prime Minister Modi, respectively. All geopolitical contradictions aside, of which there are admittedly many, Russia and Saudi Arabia have proven to be trustworthy partners over the past year in the sense that they both trailblazed last year's OPEC output deal and took the lead in renewing it just recently. Russia has also been courting Gulf investments to make up for the loss of Western capital in its economy, so it'll be interesting to see what sort of economic outcomes result from the minister's visit. As for India, Russia is cooperating with the South Asian state in constructing the transcontinental north-south transport corridor through Iran and Azerbaijan, which will ultimately link the two BRICS members together. There's also the chance that both sides might sign a massive nuclear energy deal, too. Though the Mideast and South Asia aren't exactly the regions that come to mind when people think about Russia's 21st century economic strategy, this year's SPIEF might change all of that if the right deals are sealed. So, folks, to start off this very interesting and comprehensive discussion today, we're joined by Mr. Joaquin Flores. He's editor-in-chief of Fort Roos and director of the Center for Syncretic Studies.
Trendstorm.
All right, Joaquin, how do Russia's energy relations with Saudi Arabia and OPEC impact on the overall state of its economy, and what do you expect to be the result of the kingdom's energy minister visiting SPIEF next week?
Russia-Saudi trade is critical. There is a popular view among geopolitical train spotters that Russia and Saudi Arabia are at serious odds. This is because of Saudi support for terrorism in the Middle East and the Russian Caucasus. But geopolitics and diplomacy are not revenge-motivated. They're practical. They are, though, about causing harm to one's opponents where possible, but more important, about having as many friends and allies as possible. So more to the point, Russia will not have as much leverage on Saudi Arabia as it could have otherwise, or would need to, if it did not have a relationship that could be in jeopardy in the first place. In other words, relationships have to exist in the first place for the threat of losing those relationships to mean anything. That Saudi Arabia and Russia are both oil-producing countries gives them common cause. So the U.S. has engaged in global market manipulation of crude prices by suppressing them, by increasing its own production and so forth in the energy sector in general. So in the last few years, the U.S. became so-called energy independent by opening its own production and manipulating global quotas. This, however, has hurt both Russia and the U.S.'s regional ally, Saudi Arabia. This gives Russia and Saudi Arabia a common cause. Russia beat Saudi Arabia as China's top oil supplier in 2016, and this forces Saudi Arabia to give more attention to Russia. Saudi Arabia faces an internal political crisis because of the nature and structure of the ruling family. Important decision-making positions are filled with people there by way of nepotism, and the family suffers serious divisions. This gives Russia an even more important role in being able to use not just the stick, but also the carrot in terms of resolving the conflict in Syria, where Russia and Saudi Arabia appear to be on opposing sides. But having agreements on energy prices, this will have an effect in bolstering Saudi Arabia's economy, which is dependent on those prices, as well as the situation is for Russia. But it won't just help Russia, but other important countries, which frustrate the U.S.'s Latin American regional ambitions like Venezuela. So moving away from energy engagement and more towards the real sector of the economy, I would say that when we look at the situation of Saudi-Russian ties, what we have to look at primarily is that there are broad areas that they can reach agreement on, but without the ability to look broader, a broader perspective, they will always find themselves in the same narrow alley that they have found themselves previously. So I think that coming out of SPIEF, what we will see is more of a public showing that such arrangements are possible.
Okay. I mean, Joaquin, this is very, very deep. You really cover the whole gamut of that relationship. And you also explain not only where it's going, but how it got to where it's at today and what we can look forward to with the Kingdom's energy minister visiting St. Petersburg. Now, if I can move the conversation in a different way and away from energy engagement and more towards the real sector, commercial aspect of the economy, what significance does India's north-south transport corridor have for Russia? And how does India fit into its economic strategy more broadly?
Well, India's economic strategy over the last 10-plus years has been consistent with its geopolitical one to seek as many partners as possible. And I think I've said this now a few times because this is sort of a golden rule in international relations, that it's always a positive thing to have as many partners as possible. Economic realities often in the final analysis determine geopolitical ones, at least so long as we assume sovereign decision-making at some level among any state's elites or decision-makers, and that would apply to India. To the extent that India has a higher degree of sovereignty than numerous other states that we may say fit into the developmental model emerging from the post-colonial period. And then we can look at India's North-South Transport Corridor, NSTC, as a critical piece of this. Under Modi, India has shown more signs favoring the Atlanticist bloc over the Eurasian, but we shouldn't take that too far because Modi's policies are a moment in time over a long history of that which is India. And so India's economy today is somewhere around the sixth largest in the world, according to the most standard way of evaluating GDP, which of course isn't a perfect measure, but it tells us something. And both governments, Russia and India, have long held that even the present trade figures, which have grown exponentially from even 10 or 15 years ago, are still well below their optimal capacity. The long-term fix, both leaders have agreed, as well as the business community and at the state level, through having a free trade agreement. And so they're looking towards building this free trade agreement. So both countries set up a joint study group, the JSG, to negotiate the specifications of an agreement. A final agreement would be signed between India and the Eurasian Economic Union, which of course includes a number of countries that your listeners would be well aware of. In 2016, Putin and Modi agreed to the Partnership for Global Peace and Stability, where they pledged to pursue, quote, new opportunities to take the economic ties to unprecedented heights, achieve sustainable development, promote peace and security at home and around the world, and strengthen inclusive and transparent global government and provide global leadership on issues of shared interest, end quote. So bilateral trade, Andrew, in 2002 stood at $1.5 billion and astonishingly increased to over seven times to $11 billion in 2012, with both governments setting a bilateral trade target of $30 billion by 2025. Bilateral trade between two countries in 2012 grew by over 24%, which is quite considerable. So now we look at the FTA and it shows what's possible, but it both engenders and at the same time necessitates the completion of this North-South Transport Corridor project. This is critical and I can't emphasize this enough. Now the standard route that the North-South Transport Corridor project seeks to change presently goes a long way by sea from India all the way around the Arabian Peninsula, through the Gulf of Aden, through the Red Sea, through the Suez Canal, and cross the entire stretch of the Mediterranean from east to west, then through the Strait of Gibraltar, around the Iberian Peninsula, all the way up the Atlantic coast of Spain and France, where only then through the North Sea and Baltic Sea can goods reach from India to Europe and Eastern Europe, including Russia. So, of course, this is a problem. So the NSTC, however, is a project that's well underway and has already had several successful test runs just last month, for example. In general, tests have shown transport costs were reduced by 2,500 per 15 tons of cargo over the standard long route, and that's significant. So that's really where the significance of the North-South Transport Corridor is today.
All right, Joaquin, thank you very much. I mean, that was very deep as usual, comprehensive, exactly what we're looking for. These two states, Saudi Arabia and India, might not be exactly who people think of when they try to forecast Russia's forthcoming economic relations, but you know what? You hit the nail on the head on explaining why they might be the ones. Now we're going to switch over and speak to Mr. Vladimir Radzianko. He's the managing director at the Durant.
Trendstorm.
All right, Vlad, how can OSPF provide parallel diplomatic channels for Russia's engagement with the West? And how important of a force are European businessmen in influencing their governments to forego the anti-Russian sanctions?
Well, it's actually quite interesting. This year being the 21st annual St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And if anything, I feel like this one is going to be the most interesting and the most looked after from people all over the world. I think, as you mentioned, the prime minister from India and the energy minister from Saudi Arabia will be in attendance. Last year, again, was a big media storm with Fareed Zahari, with the president of Kazakhstan and the prime minister of Italy. And there was a lot of eyes on there as far as who was going to be the next president of the U.S., what could European Union or Europe leaders, how could they convince their essentially Brussels to lift these anti-Russian sanctions? And again, that was kind of where the soundbite, where people started to find that maybe Putin was somehow looking more as Trump as a viable candidate in the presidential elections, calling him bright, and everybody obviously went crazy for that. So now that we see a year has passed and that Trump is now elected, granted, he's obviously not going to be in attendance, but now that there's this more of a warming up to Russia, despite some of the kind of bumps that we've had over the last few months since Trump was elected, you see how Trump and his administration has looked at possibly softening sanctions, or at least there's been some kind of closed-door meetings about that. The fact that Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, had met with Trump already prior to this conference, along with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. So it's actually quite interesting. We don't know exactly what was talked about behind those doors. But again, going back to Europe and going back to the fact that there's going to be more European, business leaders and political leaders there, as you said, kind of trying to find a parallel between political and business. I honestly think that Europe has already become subservient to the U.S., Now, as far as sanctions, whatever the U.S. does is what Europe is going to do. I mean, they have essentially castrated themselves over the last few years and decades, and they've brought it upon themselves that they cannot no longer make any decisions themselves. So you have countries like Italy and Spain, Portugal, Greece, who have just hit rock bottom. And honestly, it seems like it's going to go even further down. And they're begging their leaders. But obviously they're handcuffed to lift these sanctions. So I think it's not a matter of if, but when these sanctions do get lifted, whether it is from the U.S. or, kind of on the surface, it looks like it's from the European Union. So it's a matter of when. And SPIEF has become this opportunity for Westerners and people over the world to sort of get in line first, because they saw, for instance, the warming and the positive the dialogue that they had at last year's economic forum, that now they're looking at this year as becoming even more necessary. I think that was a good word, is that this economic forum in St. Petersburg has now become necessary. And I think what Vladimir Putin has done so well is that he has been able to mold this forum and to act as a diplomatic platform where they can speak about politics, for instance, at a panel, for instance, and also on the sidelines discuss certain business deals with private and public sector, with people now from the non-Western world like Saudi Arabia and India also going to be in attendance. So it's going to be extremely interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, since we're talking about this non-Western world, you know, you brought up Saudi Arabia and India, since I mentioned them in the lead-in as well. How successful do you think Russia's been in balancing between its Western and non-Western partners, and what kind of role do you see Saudi Arabia and India playing in that?
I think they're going to play a massive role. I mean, now, last week, a few days ago, you had Trump in Saudi Arabia, now in Israel, and he signed that large arms deal. It's going to value up to $300 billion in arms to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia obviously brought out the red carpet for Donald Trump, and they're trying to obviously cozy up to him. But you see, it doesn't really matter, because now the Saudi Arabia is going to be in attendance in St. Petersburg. Vladimir Putin didn't need to fly down to Riyadh for any of this. They're going to be coming to him. And this is exactly, it's indicative on the positioning of Russia right now in today's economic world, that people and decision makers are coming to him, and they're coming to this particular forum. Now, your question about how are they balancing it? I mean, they're balancing it beautifully with the West. I mean, the West is always going to be there, and Russia understands that, and they understand that they'll have to work with them. And they've said time and time again that we have absolutely no problems. And if anything, we'd love to work with the European Union and with the United States, especially Donald Trump. What's also interesting is the fact that all the deals and the closer relationship that they've had with China, and how Russia has taken a lead in creating the new world of Eurasia.
Okay, Vladimir, thanks very much. I mean, you made a pretty convincing case for why businessmen can be diplomats and how we can also see a convergence of Western and Russian interests at this year's BEEF. Thanks a lot for that.
Trendstorm.
Now, folks, if we reflect on what both of our guests have revealed to us today, we can see that BEEF is both about the old and the new. But in the present, Russia's bringing both together. By that, what I mean is we have Russia's old and traditional partners, whether they're India or some Western states, but Russia's also going forward into the future, dealing with East Asian states, Southeast Asian states, and also, very interestingly, Mideastern ones, specifically Saudi Arabia. So we're going to keep our eyes peeled on what unfolds at this year's BEEF, and let's just hope that Russia seals the best deals. So, folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this, as well as offer up your forecast for what we can expect next week, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com or find us on Facebook. Stay with us.